Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, from Campaign Number 10, En Avant to Victory, the Allied March to Yorktown, June to October 1781, in The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. It's May of 1781, and George Washington has joined forces with the French, commanded by General Rochambeau, commanding both the French Army and Navy. And they're trying to decide whether or not to attack New York or attack the British in the South, in the Chesapeake area of Virginia. On May 28, 1781, French General Rochambeau informed Admiral François-Joseph Paul de Grasse, the commanding officer of French naval forces in the West Indies, that George Washington had asked for the march of the French forces to the North River in New York to threaten and maybe attack New York in cooperation with his army in order to create a diversion for the southern states. Asking for de Grasse's cooperation, Rochambeau continued, there are two points at which an offensive can be made against the enemy, Chesapeake and New York. The southwesterly winds and the state of defense in Virginia will probably make you prefer the Chesapeake Bay, and it will be there where we think you may be able to render the greatest service, whereas you will need only 2 days to come from there to New York. In case, it is essential that you send well in advance a frigate to inform de Barras where you are to come and also George Washington. This letter by General Rochambeau of the French has been cited as evidence that the Yorktown campaign had been planned at Westerfield in the meeting between Washington and Rochambeau, but the facts do not bear out this interpretation. George Washington had no intelligence from Virginia since May 5th, when the Marquis de Lafayette informed him that British General Lord Cornwallis had left Wilmington, North Carolina, back on April 25th, 1781. On May 20th, General Lord Cornwallis was in Petersburg, Virginia, a fact not known in New Windsor until June 4th. No one could predict where General Cornwallis would be in September, and as long as he remained far inland, French Admiral de Grasse's fleet would be of little help, no matter when or with how many ships he entered the Chesapeake. Conversely, French General Rochambeau had no idea where the French Admiral de Grasse was on May 28th, 1781, when he wrote that letter. Only when the frigate L'Estacateur sailed into Boston on June 10th, almost 3 weeks after the conference between Washington and Rochambeau, did Rochambeau learn through a letter that Admiral de Grasse had written on the high seas on March 29th that he had sailed from Brest on March 22nd with 20 ships of the line, 3 frigates, and 150 transports, and would be in Santo Domingo by the end of June. If all went well, de Grasse could be in American waters by July 15th, and therefore would need to be apprised of the campaign plans of the American and the French. On July 16th, French Admiral de Grasse entered the port of Cap Francois in Santo Domingo, today's Cap Haitien in Haiti. Until then, he had been completely in the dark about Franco-American plans. It was only on July 16th that he read General Rochambeau's letter of May 28, 1781. By then, the Franco-American armies had been outside New York City for 10 days already, assuming that Admiral de Grasse would appear off the coast sometime in late July. The Continental Army had left winter quarters at Newburgh, New York on June 21st and marched along the Hudson River to Phillipsburg. On June 10th, French forces had emerged from winter quarters in Newport as well and sailed up the Providence River. That same day, French General Rochambeau told Admiral de Grasse, I do not need to hide from you, Monsieur, that these people here are at the end of their rope, that Washington does not have half the troops that he counted on having, and that I believe, though he covers himself about that he currently has not 6,000 men, but Lafayette has not 1,000 men, regular troops and militia, to defend Virginia, and that is therefore the utmost importance that you take on board as many troops as you can, that 4,000 or 5,000 men would not be too many. On June 18th, the Bourbonese Regiment of Infantry set out from Providence for New York. Marching one day apart and one regiment at a time, General Rochambeau's forces encountered their allies at White Plains on July 6th. In beholding this army, Jean-Francois Louis was struck not by its smart appearance, but by its destitution. The men were without uniforms and covered with rags. Most of them were barefoot. They were of all sizes, down to children who could not have been over 14. To Baron Ludwig von Clausen, he wrote, "It was really painful to see these brave men, almost naked with only some trousers and little linen jackets, most of them without stockings. But would you believe it? Very cheerful and healthy in appearance. What a difference to the French line, which was well lined up, of an equal height, well dressed." On July 21st, Washington and Rochambeau set out for a three-day reconnaissance of British fortifications around New York City. Impressed by enemy preparations, Washington decided that he lacked the resources to successfully conduct a siege. Between his roughly 6,000 Continental Army troops and almost 5,000 troops Rochambeau had brought to Westchester County, New York, the combined armies were still smaller than the 12,500-man British garrison in New York. The few thousand militia Washington was hoping for would not make a difference. Admiral de Grasse had written that he might be outside New York City by July 15th, but there was no sign of him. All that Washington could do was wait. On July 26th, his private secretary wrote in his diary, "The general is exceedingly anxious and finds himself in a most perplexing and ridiculous situation, not being able to determine on any fixed plan of operation from the uncertainty of his expectations and prospects." 2 weeks later, on August 11th, the frigate Concord arrived in Newport with a letter by de Grasse dated July 28th. When it was opened at Rochambeau's headquarters at John Odell House in Greenburg around noon on Tuesday, August 14th, it completely changed Washington's plans. De Grasse was on his way from Santo Domingue to render himself in all diligence to the Chesapeake Bay, the place which seems to have been indicated to me by you, General Rochambeau, and by General Washington and Admiral Saint-Laurent as the surest place to carry out the good which you propose. Though Washington had planned on the siege of New York City, he quickly shifted gears. Matters have now come to a crisis, and a decisive plan to be determined on, I was obliged, from the shortness of Admiral de Grasse's promised stay on this coast, and the apparent disinclination in their naval officers to force the harbor of New York to give up all idea of attacking the British in New York. General Rochambeau had pointed out that French ships of the line had a draft of 27 feet compared to the Royal Navy's 22 feet of draft and could not sail into New York Harbor. Washington wrote that he had decided instead to remove the French troops and detachment from the American Army to the head of the Elk to be transported to Virginia for the purpose of cooperating with the force from the West Indies against the troops in that state. Admiral de Grasse had made the decision for Washington. Once the decision to deploy to Virginia had been made, Washington sent a letter to Lafayette on August 15th, instructing him to immediately take such position as best enable you to prevent British Lord General Cornwallis' retreat through North Carolina. If Lafayette could keep Cornwallis bottled up in Yorktown, if Admiral de Grasse's French fleet appeared in time to complete the siege ring on water, and if the Allied armies could get to Yorktown before de Grasse sailed back to the West Indies, then Cornwallis might just be caught and Britain's last operational field army captured. There was no time to lose. French Admiral de Grasse had informed Washington that he would remain in American waters until October 15th. That left Washington 62 days, from August 14th to October 15th, to move his forces to Yorktown, besiege Cornwallis, and force him to surrender. But first he had to get there. At 1.2 to 1.5 miles per hour, 10 to 12 miles per day, that was the speed of the oxen pulling the wagons. The distance from Phillipsburg to Yorktown was almost 500 miles. with a few days of rest and delays crossing the Delaware, Susquehanna, and Potomac rivers, Washington could hope to arrive outside Yorktown within 50 days, around October 7th to the 8th, unless Admiral de Grasse could be convinced to extend his stay. That left barely a week to force the surrender of Lord Cornwallis and the British Army. For months, Washington, Rochambeau, and de Grasse had exchanged letters, not knowing where the recipient was and when he would receive the missive, when he would reply, and whether the issues raised would still be valid when the response arrived. The same old truths for Washington's letters to Lafayette. On August 15th, he did not know that by digging in at Yorktown and Gloucester since August 2nd, Cornwallis had done exactly what the Americans would have wanted him to do. On the morning of August 18th, Rochambeau's French forces, almost 300 officers and 4,400 men, broke camp and began their march to Virginia. Since Washington had to leave around 3,500 men under General William Heath outside New York City to keep watch on Sir Henry Clinton's 12,000 British soldiers, the Continental Army that crossed the Hudson River in the days after August 18th was only about 2,400 officers and men strong. Marching on three parallel routes across New Jersey, the Americans reached Trenton less than 2 weeks later on August 31st. On September 2nd, they paraded before the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Over the next 2 days, French forces marched through the city as well. As the Allied armies continued toward the Delaware state line, French General Rochambeau and his aides-de-camp took a staff ride down the Delaware River, guided by artillery captain Maudet Dupuy. Approaching the landing site at Marcus Hook in the mid-afternoon of September 5th, Baron Closen discerned in the distance General Washington standing on the shore and waving his hat and a white handkerchief joyfully. There was good reason for this, for he informed us as we disembarked that Admiral de Grasse had arrived in Chesapeake Bay with 28 ships of the line and 3,000 troops. What he did not know was that just about then, the British and French fleets had begun firing at each other in the waters off the Chesapeake. On August 5th, de Grasse had raised anchor with his 28 ships of the line and 4 frigates at Cap Francois for the most perfectly executed naval campaign of the age of sail. Besides their crew and almost 3,000 soldiers drawn from regular line infantry regiments supplementing the ship garrisons, his vehicles carried the soldiers of the infantry regiments, 100 artillerymen and their guns, and 100 hussars, altogether some 3,300 men under Claude Anne de Revoy, Marquis de Saint-Simon-Montbleu. Along the way, Admiral de Grasse dispatched a frigate to Havana to pick up 1.2 million liras for Rochambeau. On August 17th, the frigate Le Gargette rejoined de Grasse's fleet as it emerged from the channel between Cuba and the Bahamas. The admiral had chosen that rarely used route in a successful bid to avoid detection by Admiral Samuel Hood. Aware that de Grasse had departed for the American mainland, Admiral George Bridges Rodney had ordered Hood to take the British fleet to New York by way of the Chesapeake and Delaware Bays. Hood sailed from Antigua on August 10th, and though he had a longer route and departed 5 days after de Grasse, his 14 copper ships outsailed the French fleet and arrived off the Chesapeake on August 25th. Sighting no French vessels, Hood sailed on to New York, arriving on August 31st. Along the way, Hood missed the 8 ships of the line, 4 frigates, and 18 transports of Admiral de Barras, who had taken his squadron with the siege artillery out of Newport on August 23rd and was on his way to Virginia. On August 31st, Barras's fleet was just south of New York City, but far out on the Atlantic to avoid detection. Upon arrival in New York City, Admiral Thomas Graves added Hood's 14 vessels to his own, and on August 31st, he hurried back to Virginia. For the second time in a week, the British and French fleets missed each other in the vastness of the Atlantic between the New York and the Chesapeake. The ship's crews assisting in the landing of Saint-Simon's troops had not yet returned when the lookouts aboard the frigate L'Arquette reported sighting Graves' fleet of 2 98-gun vessels, 12 74s, 170 four 64s, a 50-gun ship, six frigates, and a fire ship. Sailing at full speed around 6 knots or 7 miles per hour, they were making straight for the entrance of the 10-mile-wide bay. The frigate La Correct hurried back to alert Admiral de Grasse. There was not much he could do. Not only were wind and tide against him, but he had to leave 90 officers and about 1,900 crew members behind. De Grasse's ships did not clear the bay until almost 1 in the afternoon. Rather than order close action and head straight for the disorganized French fleet, Graves gave orders to get into the line ahead formation. Following the Admiralty's fighting instruction, which demanded that battle be waged in close formation, with each ship engaging her opponent, Graves wanted to bring his British vessels into a roughly parallel position with the French fleet. That meant that his ships, sailing west by southwest, had to turn almost 180 degrees to change course to east-southeast and head back out to sea. The maneuver not only took 1.5 hours to perform, it also reversed the order of his ships. His best and fastest ships, which had been in the lead, now found themselves at the rear of the column, with 3 badly leaking ships under Sir Francis Drake forming the new lead division. The maneuver gave French Admiral de Grasse time to clear the bay. The two fleets were arranged like the sides of a funnel when Graves raised the flag for close action. It was 3:46 in the afternoon. At 4:15, the Royal Navy commenced firing, but confusion reigned aboard the British fleet. In her memorandum compiled the day after the battle, Hood claimed that Graves did not lower the ensign signaling line ahead as the standard for close action went up. Claiming they did not know which signal to follow, Hood's division stayed line ahead. To remedy the situation, Graves had sent a frigate to order Hood to attack, but it was too late. 7 ships, including Horde's Balfour, never caught up. When battle commenced, French Admiral de Grasse had 5 more ships, with 1,700 cannon compared to British Admiral Graves' 1,400 British guns, sailing in closer formation than the Royal Navy. De Grasse's best vessels, forming the vanguard of his fleet, fired broadside after broadside into British Sir Francis Drake's ships, the worst in Graves' fleet. By 6:30 that evening, it was getting too dark to continue the fight, and Graves ordered his ships to disengage. The Royal Navy had suffered 336 casualties, and the 74-gun ships, Alex, Shrewsbury, and Terrible, were almost unsailable. The Terrible had to be burned at sea a few days later. The Montague, also a 74, was in danger of losing her masts. The Intrepid, struck by 65 cannonballs in the first volley alone, had to leave the fleet with a broken rudder. On the French side, several ships also needed repair. About 240 French soldiers were casualties of the battle. For the next few days, the fleets drifted southward until de Grasse decided on September 10th to return to the Chesapeake. Tactically, the battle was a draw, but strategically, it was a huge French victory. After 18 days on the Atlantic, Barras had slipped into the bay on September 10th. The next day, Admiral de Grasse joined him there. By drawing the Royal Navy away from the Chesapeake, he had opened the way for Barras to safely bring in the siege guns. With the addition of Barras's vessels, Admiral de Grasse now had 36 ships of the line. Graves, with only 18, decided on September 13th to return to New York City, where he arrived on September 20th. The naval superiority that George Washington had hoped for had been achieved. The siege ring on water was established. Things were looking grim for Cornwallis, and Graves knew it. As the two fleets drifted southward, Washington and his army headed for Head of Elk on September 6th. On September 7th, the 1st French Brigade joined them, and the 2nd Brigade arrived on September 8th. Once the rear guard had arrived, the two armies were ready for the last leg of the journey. But there was grumbling in the ranks. The Continental Army wanted to get paid, and it was. This day, September 8th, remember Major William Popham, will be famous in the annals of history for being the first time in which the troops of the United States received 1 month's pay in specie. For many, a Continental soldier, this was indeed the first and only time he was ever paid with silver. Washington had borrowed the friends from Rochambeau, who paid his troops for his supplies in specie. The approximately 20 million livres in gold and specie silver his army spent had a huge economic impact by nearly doubling the amount of specie circulating in the United States. While his troops were embarking, Washington rode on to Mount Vernon, which he had not seen since early in 1775. Following their visit on September 9th to the 12th, Washington and Rochambeau continued their journey to Williamsburg. In the morning of September 12th, Trumbull recorded that between Colchester and Dumfries, meet letters giving an account of the action between the two fleets and that the French had gone out from the bay in pursuit of the English. The event not known, much agitated. With all of 130 miles to go, the outcome of the campaign once again hung in the balance. The next day they heard rumors of the return of the French fleet with some advantage, which relieved our fears. Hurrying on, Washington reached Williamsburg on September 14th. About 6 this afternoon, a witness wrote, we were agreeably alarmed with intelligence that General Washington was within 1 mile of our camp. The troops immediately paraded and with inexpressible joy renewed and saluted that good, great general. The joy that appeared in everyone's face requires an abler pen than mine to describe his arrival in camp. Only now did Washington learn of the fortunate outcome of the Battle of the Capes between the British and the French navies. Washington and General Rochambeau had arrived, but where were their troops? On September 11th, most of the Continental Army and about 1,200 men from French General Rochambeau's forces set sail from Head of Elk. The remainder of the French forces, close to 3,500 officers and men, as well as the 1st and 2nd New York regiments with about 800 officers and men, and the 350-man-strong Rhode Island regiment, marched on to Baltimore. Taken aback by the poor quality of the boats assembled at Fells Point, Charles Hacien de Hoc, Baron de Rome, Rochambeau's second-in-command, decided to march overland to Yorktown and left Baltimore on September 17th. Later that day, Villeneuve learned that de Grasse had sent transports to Annapolis to take his troops to Virginia. In the early evening of September 21st, the men set sail for College Landing, where they arrived on September 24th. 2 days later, they were joined by their comrades who had embarked at Head of Elk. News of de Grasse's hurried departure on September 5th to meet a British fleet had reached the flotilla as it put into Annapolis in the evening of September 12th. Here they anxiously awaited for the outcome of the battle. If Graves emerged victorious, the guns of the Royal Navy would be waiting at New Point Comfort for the dozens of small boats carrying the Allied forces. When news of Admiral de Grasse's safe return to the Chesapeake Bay reached Annapolis in the evening of September 14th, the troops reboarded and debarked at College Landing 12 days later, on September 26th. That same day, the last link of the siege ring around Cornwallis fell into place. On September 14th, Lauzun's 300 French hussars rode out of Baltimore for Yorktown. At Fredericksburg, 4 days later, they received orders to change their route and ride to Gloucester Courthouse opposite Yorktown, where Brigadier General George Wheaton's Virginia Militia was unable to stop the depredations of Colonel John Simcoe's Queen's Rangers. The Hussars joined Wheaton on September 24th, reinforcing the siege ring on the left bank of the York River, which became stronger still when the Legion's infantry arrived there 3 days later. In the morning of September 28th, the Allied armies set out for Yorktown in three columns. The Continental Army, almost 6,000 strong, now that Lafayette's division had been added to Washington's corps, formed the right flank of the siege forces. About 3,300 militia brought American forces to a little over 9,000 men. The Bourbonnais Regiment, part of French General Rochambeau's almost 5,000-strong corps, marched in the center, and the Agonized Regiment, part of Saint-Simon's 3,500-strong division, formed the left column. Taking the most direct road from Williamsburg, the Agonaut was the first to make contact with the British at around 3:30 in the afternoon. The following day, Allied forces established a preliminary siege ring around Cornwallis, who abandoned his outer defensive works on September 30th, thus allowing Allied forces to approach even closer. Fearing that Cornwallis might transport his approximately 7,100 men across the York River and break through the siege lines in Gloucester, Washington strengthened Allied forces on October 1st with 800 infantrymen detached from the ships' garrisons of Admiral de Grasse's fleet. On October 2nd, General Gabriel de Choisy, who had taken command in Gloucester, felt strong enough to move closer to the British positions. Shortly before noon on October 3rd, Lauzun's 300 hussars pushed an equal number of Lieutenant Colonel Banstroy Tarleton's dragoons of the British Legion back behind their earthworks in the largest cavalry engagement of the War of Independence. There, the 1,000-man British garrison stayed for the remainder of the siege. Cornwallis's last escape route was closed off. During the night of October 6th, Allied soldiers began digging the trenches for the first parallel or siege line at a distance of 500 to 600 yards from British works. As they dug through the night, they were safe from British fire. When Cornwallis became aware of the activities the next morning, his artillery opened up on the besiegers. But his guns would soon be silenced. On October 6th, the oxen of the recently arrived American wagon train began to pull the first guns of the siege artillery from Admiral Barras's vessels at Jamestown Landing and into their emplacements before Yorktown. Around 4 that evening on October 9th, the Continental Standard was hoisted over the Grand American Battery on the far right of the trenches closest to the York River. As Washington put the fuse to the touch hole of a 36-pound cannon, the discharge became the signal for a furious artillery barrage that erupted all along the siege line. Reading from Campaign Number 10, In Avant of Victory, the Allied March to Yorktown, June to October 1781, in the 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution, will be continued. This has been American History. This is Wallace Klinghunst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.